Yeah, but I mean, children?
Well, I've had the children's court for the past, well, since August. When Judge Singleton had it, then I took on as his successor, and then until the 1st of February, and I've had Ripley and had it for a year.
You should know all about sex, but now.
Well, you know, I did have a lot of straight cases for the past 2 years, both in Angus and Bethlehem.
We'll call this, murder, the record and reflect the presence of a war. Just a preliminary note, Gary Stern, who's been working on the code in depth for some time, opened the meeting with a brief rundown of the proposed revision. We'll then hear some additional testimony from Carolyn Berg and Karen Davis, who wish to make some presentation. As in the past, Gary is open for questions at any time. So with that brief bit of, Gary, you're on again.
Okay. If you recall, in the opening day on Monday, I was talking about the sources of the list of existing Alaska law, and I pointed out that most are based on law existing in Oregon and New York approximately 100 years ago. Well, with the rape statute, we're pretty fortunate since we went back as far as 1750 to have the existing rape statute. Blackstone, in his work, described rape as the carnal knowledge of a woman forcibly against her will. This is identical to the existing definition of rape, except for the fact that it's not limited to women, it's to a person. And I think in reviewing the existing provisions on sexual offenses, the subcommission concluded that the existing provisions were totally inadequate to deal with the area. In restructuring the area of sexual offenses, the subcommission created 4 degrees of sexual assault. And you have a chart in front of you, and probably the best way to introduce you to the crimes are just to go through the chart. The main distinction between the various degrees of sexual offenses in the revised code is whether sexual penetration as opposed to sexual contact occurred. Penetration is defined to include penetration by any part of the body or any object into genital opening or the anus. Sexual contact is described to include the mere touching of certain specified areas. And those areas include the anus, the breast, and the genital areas. So we have those two basic terms, sexual penetration and sexual contact. And we have 4 degrees of offenses. First and third degree offenses, which are on the top of the page, are the offenses involving sexual penetration. The second and fourth degree offenses on the bottom of the page are the offenses involving sexual contact. And they range from an A felony for the first degree to an A misdemeanor for the fourth degree. It goes A felony, B felony, C felony, A misdemeanor. Now, for first degree sexual assault, which is the most serious form of conduct in the revised code in the sexual offenses area, there are three ways that can be done. The first one is without consent. And the term without consent is used in the revised code in place of the term that I referred to previously, forcibly and against the will. And the definition of without consent emphasizes that resistance is not necessary. All that is necessary is that the victim be coerced by the use of force or by the threat of force against her or property. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say against the victim. It could be against any person. So in other words, a threat to injure someone else would be sufficient to constitute without consent. And in reviewing cases in other states which were functioning under our definition, forcibly and against the will, we came across language which required the victim to resist until the act had been completed, basically saying that unless you physically resist throughout, it's not a rape. Even one case I just was reading today where there was even an issue of whether it was without consent, where the victim had been kidnapped by six men. So that's the main form of sexual assault without consent. The next category is when the victim is under 13. This is the statutory rape situation. Now, existing law recognizes basically one form of statutory rape depending on whether the victim was under 16. The subcommission concluded that here a distinction could be made between victims that were under 13 and victims that were under 16. And consequently, when someone engages in sexual penetration with a person under 13, regardless of whether it or not is without consent, he will be guilty, he or she will be guilty of first-degree sexual assault. And by adding he or she, I should point out that the entire code is sex-neutral. Sexual assault can be committed by a male upon a male, or male upon a female, female upon a male, whatever. The third category of first-degree sexual assault is when the defendant and the victim are related, and the defendant is over 18 and the victim is under 18. And this is your incest-type situation, and it's an aggravating factor. You could have a situation where the victim was over, we'll see that when the victim is over 13 but under 16, it's not as serious. Well, the subcommission concluded then when the victim is under 13 and, I'm sorry, over 13 and under 18, it should be first-degree sexual assault. Now, second-degree sexual assault is identical to the first-degree offense, except for the fact that instead of having sexual penetration, all that you have is sexual contact. There was a touching of the genital areas as opposed to penetration. And it's hoped that this will make it, in cases where penetration may be difficult to prove, you will have this lesser included of sexual contact. So first and second degree are identical, except for the fact that one involves sexual penetration and whereas the other one involves sexual contact. One's an A felony, the other's a B felony. Now, moving on to third degree, we get back into the sexual penetration category. And here we have the situation where the defendant is 18 or older and the victim is under 16. So if the victim is young, but it isn't that young, in other words, if the victim is not under 13, it will only be a third degree crime, and that would be a C felony. In addition, we said that when the victim is incapacitated, regardless of whether it is without consent, it will be a C felony. And that would cover situations where the victim might be mentally incapable of giving consent or would be physically incapacitated, for example, would be drunk. Now, when we go down to fourth degree, we have the same categories as we did for the third degree offense, except, again, sexual contact is involved. There was one change, and that was, whereas in the third degree offense, when penetration is involved, the defendant has to be 18 or older. Whereas when sexual contact is involved, the defendant has to be 19 or over. And the commission was concerned about perhaps including high school petting within the prohibitions of the sexual assault article and therefore made the age of 19. Excuse me? That was certainly not the concern. The concern was not to have, for example, a high school senior be guilty of a sexual assault for going with a 15-year-old or 17-year-old. Now, those are the four degrees of sexual assault, and in defining these terms, in defining these crimes, the commission also considered three statutes which, as they apply to consensual activities behind adults, with adults, in private, without any force, the subcommission concluded that such activities should not be included in the criminal code. And the three statutes I'm talking about is adultery, cohabitation, and sodomy. I think that the one that would probably have the most public interest is the sodomy statute. We currently have a sodomy statute which provides, I believe, a maximum of 10 years imprisonment for an act of sodomy. Now, based on recent amendments to that statute over the last 2 years, I read the sodomy statute to cover only conduct between two people which involves penetration of the anus. And it doesn't have to be, it's not just homosexuality. It is also consenting adults that are perhaps married in private. And that is under existing law. and a act of sexual penetration, which involves the anus, faces a maximum of 10 years imprisonment. Now, in deciding to eliminate those offenses, the subcommission did not, it's pointed out that in the book that large people may share with, large groups of people may share with the subcommission sentiment regarding the immorality of some of this conduct. However, because of the fact that there has been no history of enforcement of these statutes, because of the fact that under the guidelines set forth in the Supreme Court's decision of Raven, it's at least the questionable constitutionality and the potential for a capricious application of these offenses, of these crimes, to perhaps be used to get someone who you can't get under any other type of crime, and just basically because of non-enforcement of the criminal law, leading to contempt of the criminal law, it was felt that this should not be included in the criminal code. So you have those offenses are not included in the book, but it's important to stress that at least that with sodomy, for example, we are not saying that sodomy is legal. What we're saying is that consensual sodomy is legal if it's between adults. If it's forcible, it's going to be sexual penetration. Our definition of sexual penetration includes penetration of the anus. And insofar as it involves children, it'll be covered by the code, because sexual penetration with children is considered a very serious offense, an A felony. Again, we're only limited to consenting adults in private and no force. One aspect of the code that is, I know, been the subject of a number of letters has been the spousal immunity section, which provides that a person does not commit the crime of sexual assault if the victim is his or her legal spouse, unless the spouses are living apart and one of them is filed for divorce. Now, I believe that in this section, the commission changed existing Alaska law by providing that even though there hasn't been a divorce in a situation where you've been married, you can file for, you can make a complaint for sexual assault if you are living apart. Rape under common law was defined as, it was defined to exclude the situation where you could not have rape under common law by a male upon his wife, and under our statute, of course, by a female upon the male. Now, there is no explicit provision in the existing statutes which exclude this type of conduct. However, in 1975, I believe, an amendment was added to the rape statute, which deals with this tricky subject of accomplice liability. For example, a man could hire someone to rape his wife, and in those situations, the man would be guilty of rape as an accomplice. And the legislature apparently found it necessary to deal with that situation specifically in a section of the rape statute. And I can only conclude that the reason they had to deal with it specifically is because, number one, it is excluded under the definition of rape, because it is called rape, and that term is always excluded spousal situations. One very strong point about this code is the fact that in defining sexual contact as an offense, as a very serious offense, we're closing a very big gap in existing Alaska law. Currently today, we have a statute which prohibits lewd and lascivious acts with a child. Well, I don't want to go into detail now about that statute in terms of how it's written in terms of lewd and lascivious acts, but it's interesting to note that it only covers lewd and lascivious acts with a child. If you are dealing with an adult, there is no statute covering a sexual assault upon an adult which does not amount to rape, attempted rape, or assault with intent to commit rape. So currently, I believe that the lewd and lascivious statute has a 10-year max, and it's limited to people under 16. Well, whatever lewd and lascivious means, if it occurs with someone over 16, it's not considered lewd and lascivious, and all you can go for is basically, I think it's fair to say, it's an assault or assault and battery. And that has a 6-month maximum sentence. The subcommission concluded that whatever lewd and lascivious is applied to children, it should also apply to adults when it's forcible, and it should be treated severely as a felony. And again, we define what lewd and lascivious is by our definition of sexual contact. also have an indecent exposure statute here. This is getting off now the main 4 degrees of sexual assault, but we've included an indecent exposure statute here. Our current statute must be based on laws before 1900 because it refers to exposure of private parts. It refers to taking part in a model artist exhibition, it doesn't really mean anything. We define the crime of indecent exposure. We explicitly pointed out what objects, what parts of the body have to be exposed, and what culpable mental state the actor must act with. We also considered the issue of reasonable mistake as to age in statutory rape cases. And this situation would come about, for example, where a person would be accused of sexual assault or rape, and would argue that the victim appeared to be over the age of consent. Under existing Alaska law, although the point has never been decided, this very issue, the court has recognized that in another, for another statute, I believe it was the delinquency statute, that people who have relationships with minors do so in their peril. Well, the commission decided that when you're dealing with when you're dealing with the third and fourth degree sexual assaults, that is when the victim could be anywhere from 13 to 16, if the defendant could prove by preponderance of the evidence that he reasonably believed the victim to be above that age, that would be a defense. However, the commission also concluded that when the victim was under 13, it was tough luck. You did act at your peril. There was no excuse, no matter how old that victim looked. That's it. I just want to say, I consider that the sexual offenses reform is probably one of the most important in the code. And I'm not discussing here the area of eliminating those three statutes. I think in restructuring the rape statutes and the lewd and lascivious statutes, the subcommission substantially improved existing law.
Thank you, Mr. Stern. For the benefit of the audience, the gentleman who just joined us at the table, Representative Merle Snyder, and Dan Hickey from the DA's office, has done a tremendous amount of work on the code revision. Barry, you're not running off, are you?
I'll just get some more.
Don't run off.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir.
I have two other members of the Department of Law here today that I asked to come specifically. One is Mr. Bob Bundy, who's the district attorney from Nome, who happened to be in town for another matter. And I asked Bob to take a quick look at the draft of Part 1 to come over to give the committee some of his general impressions of the work we've done so far as a prosecutor, and specifically to address himself to the sex offenses provision. Since a large percentage of the felony cases he deals with in Nome does involve sex offenses. The other individual from the department is Assistant Attorney General Ann Carpinetti, who has recently participated in a federally sponsored seminar on rape and victims of rape offenses. And I thought that she might be able to tell us a little something about how our proposed sex offense provisions fit into the discussion that's sort of taking place at the national level with respect to rape and similar offenses. If the committee would care to entertain their testimony.
Certainly would. Do we have questions for Mr. Stern?
First of all, Barry, I want to say that I think you've done a wonderful job on this, too. I think it is very far-reaching and a great improvement over our custom laws, and I'm really, really happy about it. I want to congratulate the Secretary on making the changes. I have a couple of questions. One is don't we have a law against fornication, too, at present?
Well, it's... When I refer to the cohabitation statute, I believe it says cohabitating in a state of, it's on page 109. It's a person who cohabits with another in a state of adultery or fornication.
I see. Okay.
So I don't think it's, I just assume refer to it as the cohabitation statute.
I knew that the word was in the law somewhere.
Yeah.
The other thing is that I'm really delighted to hear you talk about the spouse community in terms that I feel are vulnerable. The only reason you gave for retaining the spousal immunity section was that it's always been that way, and I think that's the worst possible reason for the community. And so I feel as though we can maybe get a chance to not retain it. I'm I don't think it should be retained. I don't think there's any justification for physical violence by anyone against anyone, whether they're married or not. I mean, certainly there shouldn't be any responsible immunity involved. So I'm sure that I'll bring this up again and again and again. But I'm just delighted you don't have any good reason for it.
Well, I think I do have some good reasons. And I went quickly over this entire area. And if you'd like it to go into a little more detail on spousal immunity.
Or whatever you want.
Certainly, please. Okay. This was considered at the subcommittee meeting in a fair amount of detail. I do recall that this was a unanimous decision, and I think that the subcommittee was primarily impressed with the testimony of one of the subcommittee members at the time, Ms. Bev Cutler, who is a public defender. And her concern was the fact that this type of conduct, this type of charge is likely to come up when a marriage has basically fallen apart and a person is seeking some type of grounds for a divorce or to have a settlement, perhaps, that they would like. And she at least thought that you're dealing here with human conduct that does occur significantly, at least the charge, and you're going to be getting the court system to a morass of charges. We were also concerned about the privacy aspect of it in terms of how do you go about doing this. I mean, you bug the bedroom to find out. And frankly, the commission also concluded that in cases where there is some type of injury, see, no one is saying that the spouse did not commit a crime. What we're saying is he did not commit sexual assault. He may have committed assault. In fact, he has committed assault the way we have defined it. If there's been physical injury, it's a higher degree. But I believe that the way we have defined simple assault, which does apply here, the male will be guilty of an offense. If he wants to prosecute, or if he wants to prosecute, it's there. You have the simple assault statute. Maybe someday we're going to come to that. At least the subcommission, in terms of removing the spousal immunity, at least right now, the subcommission concluded unanimously not to. And again, I don't think it was just because we've always done it that way.
Why do you have to bug the bedroom any more than you have to bug any other case of rape? You mentioned having to bug the bedroom in order to be approved. Why should that be any more necessary between spouses than it is in any other case?
Well, I guess I assume it was the concern that there was one person's word against the other there. And the way we have I think it's necessary to consider this issue in terms of how we define without consent. I think this is a change from at least the law as it's set out in the statute by saying that resistance is not necessary specifically in the statute, by saying that it could be by threat, express or implied threat of physical injury. You have the situation where the spouse comes home, forces himself perhaps on the other spouse, and the next day it's a rape charge, perhaps a sexual assault charge, and without having this element of forcible resistance, it was felt that that there could be a lot more of those charges.
I think you're right. There probably would be a lot more of those charges because, as I understand, there are a lot of cases of rape in marriages. But if a spouse forces himself or herself on the other spouse, isn't that just as forceful as any other type of rape? Don't you have to work just as hard to prove it? Don't you have the same set of circumstances, really, as far as the physical act is concerned?
I think maybe Mr. Hickey could address himself to that.
I've got to, too. I mean, if I may. Having been family court judge for the past 6 months, and then previous to that, I did lots of family court cases over the years. The disaffection of people in a really domestic critical situation is such that this would be just another useful tool, and one that would be frequently employed, just to make the situation, because people, that's the type of situation, that's probably the only type of litigation that people don't want to improve, they want to make it
need another type of means. The domestic cases are the most always extremely explosive, you know, when they get into the real hassle situation. And this would be just another means in domestic cases of the ability beating each other.
But don't you have confidence in your ability to discern what is, you know, what is really happening usually? I mean, that's what judges and juries are supposed to be there for. I agree that it might be used by people. But I have confidence in your ability to be able to discern when it's being used and when it's not. And as for it making more work, I mean, every crime makes more work. If we use that argument, we should just wipe all crimes off.
But the thing that we've got so many crimes now, we can't keep a handle on. We can't.
I
mean, the whole situation is running away from us. Just don't give us any more crimes. Let's try to.
Well, I'll trade you. I'll give you the spousal immunity. You give me the spousal immunity back, or I'll give it to you. And I'll take away murder. And you don't have to worry about any murder cases, because that's a crime too. I mean,
except that murder is one which has severe social impact. The domestic cases, we're going to have them anyway. You know, we don't need another serious vehicle within
social,
that context.
But I could go on all day.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I can add a little bit from a prosecutor's perspective on the thing. First of all, as a prosecutor, I look at a case from an ethical point of view. Bringing a charge, particularly a serious felony charge, against any person is, in and of itself, a very heavy matter, absent a conviction. Subjecting a person to all of the prerogatives available to the state through the process of a felony conviction, in and of itself, regardless of what happens, is, in my judgment, as an ethical matter, a very substantial thing. And the kinds of cases that one could expect to arise through a complete removal of the spousal immunity provision in the offense of rape are almost always going to arise in a situation of vindictiveness, where one spouse, where the marriage is broken up for some reason, and one spouse, as a part of divorce proceedings or other proceedings, wants to seek to initiate a criminal prosecution in addition to that in order to gain leverage in another not necessarily related proceeding. There's a very vivid example I think I can cite the commission to that occurred in the state of Indiana as late as 1968. Indiana had at that time a statute that read very similar to our Crimes Against Nature statute that was struck down in the Harris case. And it included things like consensual sodomy between two adults. And the particular case was a situation where a wife came to a prosecutor and alleged that her husband had engaged in sodomy with her some 3 months before, and they had since split up. A criminal charge was brought against this. He was prosecuted and sentenced to a term of 14 years as a result of it.
I don't think that's if he actually did it. You know, I can't seem to get through to you guys. Isn't it a crime? And isn't it something that she has a right to seek redress of?
Well, it is definitely a crime of assault. There's no question about that. There's absolutely no question about that. But given the fact that we've eliminated, and I think with a tremendous amount of justification, the requirement of resistance. And given the fact that now all you have to essentially prove is that the sexual penetration was engaged in without consent, I think that you have to read that in conjunction with what you're advocating, Mr. Redwood, in terms of an abolition of the spousal immunity. And you basically get an awful lot of very equivocal situations. First of all, they're going to be all of them are going to be one-on-one situations. And they're going to be all situations where two parties are tremendously antagonistic towards each other. And situations where any reasonable finder of fact is not going to be able to sort out the mess that's there in terms of finding someone guilty of a heavy, serious felony charge.
Then you find the person not guilty if you can't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt.
The point I guess I was trying to make in terms of applying an ethical standard to screening cases is that the standard that I've imposed on the district attorney's offices throughout the state with the concurrence of the attorney general is that as an ethical matter, we do not file charge against a person unless, at the time we file it, we conclude that we have legally admissible evidence in the case that would justify a reasonable finder of fact to convict the person of the offense alleged on proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
That's fine. I don't quibble with that at all. If you have the evidence, do it. Don't do it. But to write it out of the law, even the possibility of gaining redress, is just crazy.
It seems that Chair might address a question, obviously, the judge, Mr. Hickey. It seems like the best defense that's coming up in the conclusion of subparagraph D is that it's almost a housekeeping matter for the court system.
It's more that concerning the nature of the people involved in the controversy at the outset, and a bitter domestic quarrel, that it would be a very easily abused and very useful tool for somebody that really wanted to bring the forces of the law to bear on the other party. In other words, it would very easily be subject to abuse, and more so than any other consideration I can think of in the domestic relations field. Domestic relations courts are the most, passions run the highest, and the opportunity for contemptuous conduct or for open outbursts is much, much higher even than in criminal trials. The domestic, when there is a contested divorce case in which the party's feelings run high, there's nothing more spiteful than the attitudes of the people in those cases. Any other type of litigation pales beside it. And the opportunity for a spouse in one of those situations to abuse the other by bringing such a charge, because there may have been sexual intercourse, for that person to try to convert that sexual intercourse into a sexual offense is very easy and could be very easily be abused. And I mean, the likelihood and opportunity for abuse is so great in this situation that I think that the commission has correctly decided to hold as they have. And Lisa, I don't think the analogy of murder is apt. I think that it's a totally different situation.
Choose another kind of assault or
something,
rather than murder. It's not
as serious as murder, but it's a very serious. Yeah, it is serious. I don't. It isn't the seriousness that concerns me. It's the opportunity for
abuse. Mr. Chairman, I'll just say one more thing. There is opportunity to abuse almost any law, almost any provision in the law. That's what we have courts for. That's what we have juries for. That's what we have lawyers for. So that everybody's interest can be protected, and so that the truth of the matter can be found. Anyone can file a suit on any basis whatsoever at any time, except that a woman can't file against her husband for raping her, or vice versa. And it's just crazy. It's just plain crazy. I trust Judge Lewis and the other judges of this state to be able to discern where the truth lies and when cases are being filed seriously. I trust Mr. Hickey to decide the same thing if he doesn't want to prosecute. But to just simply blanket them, outlaw that provision that a spouse has some kind of redress available to him or her is just insane. That's all.
For the members of the audience, Representative Elias has just joined us. Dan, did you want to follow up on that?
I'd like to ask Mrs. Rudd how she thinks a case should be filed if a woman, assuming we remove the spouse on you, walked in to a district attorney's office or to a police department and gave a very detailed statement of what took place a day or a night or 10 minutes or whatever before between her and her husband, that they'd both been drinking, for example, had come home from a party, her husband expressed an interest in engaging in sexual intercourse. She said no, he said yes, and she said, I'm not going to, and he says, if you don't, I'm going to beat you up. She says, all right. Okay. If that had been outside the context of the marriage under this statute, it would clearly be sexual assault under the provisions that are before you. There are no marks on her of any kind. Let's add another fact that let's say it's the next day, and it's not possible to get the kind of medical test that proved whether, in fact, they did have intercourse. Or let's say it is possible, and that she said, well, earlier that evening we did have consensual sexual intercourse, and, you know, I didn't want to later because he'd been drinking or whatever. How would you suggest that a case like that be handled? And, she's outraged. The law says that's rape, and I demand that you prosecute my husband.
I don't know how it'd be handled because I'm not a lawyer.
If those facts were presented to you as a juror, and she testified just to that on the stand, and the husband got on the stand and testified and said, we had intercourse before we went out, came back, and I expressed an interest in having intercourse. We had an argument about it. She refused, and I slept on the couch. How would you decide as a juror? The experience we've had with, for example, adultery cases, the few adultery cases that any more do get referred, are always in situations where someone wants to get even. They're always in that situation. They want to get even with somebody else for private purposes. The vast majority of assault and battery cases, minor assault and battery cases that involve spouses, almost always turn into situations where the police officer and the prosecutor turn out to be the bad guy in the end, in the eyes of both the victim and the defendant. Because the victim comes in one day and insists that so-and-so be prosecuted. Charges are filed. 3 days later, they make up. And in they come, and they insist that they be dropped. And I've had cases like that where I said,
yeah,
no, they're not going to be dropped. You're going to be forced to testify. And that is a very difficult question.
Yes, it is. It is a very difficult question. But that is not a reason for eliminating it from the possibility of being resolved.
Can we, has anybody got anything new to add?
We've gone through
our fifth rerun now. I know. I'm trying to get to you. That's the whole point. We have other witnesses who want to speak. Is there anything else?
Sorry for going on as long as I did, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benjamin.
I think Lisa makes some good points. I don't think we can argue with that. I do think there's some considerations, though, or at least in my part, that sometimes, you know, things just aren't black and white. You have to settle for some gray, I guess. And I think that probably when you marry someone and you agree and you somewhat consent to sexual, you make a consent to sex when you marry or when you cohabitate, whether you're married or not. The very fact that you've agreed to have relations with this person over a period of time, isn't the same to me as if I have no relation and a lady's never made any commitment to me to sleep with me or to have sex with me or anything. That's a very serious offense, I think, and that's when we call it. I would always want to see that race is considered an extremely serious offense. And I think that once you have, by marriage or consent,
I didn't mean to interrupt. I'm sorry. I'm just looking.
Okay. Once you enter into a marriage or you consent, I think somehow or another you take away from the seriousness of that crime. If every time you someone gets in the family beef or an argument, I think those that testified a moment ago are right. I know from my experience in the police department, now every family beef you go on, all the tempers are high and they make a lot of charges of what she and he did, not necessarily in sex, but you usually find out most of them aren't true anyway. But rather than to try to resolve those, usually most people don't get arrested. They try to agree that everybody will go home or separate or something. I think we ought to watch real carefully when two people agree to sleep with each other and have sex and generally everything goes fine, but then some night some problem occurs. If we start trying to get that involved in the serious crime of rape, I'm afraid that it's going to melt down in some people's view the importance of rape. I like to see rape as something that's like murder. It's a very serious crime, and if you don't have a lady's consent, she hasn't agreed to sleep with you, and she hasn't agreed to marry you, then that should be viewed entirely different. then once she's consented to all this, but then we get in there, and then I think the word rape and sex kind of goes out of it, and we get back to whether I'm assaulting her, and then, of course, I think if you force yourself on her, then you're entitled to be prosecuted. I think that's she should have the right to come and say he assaulted me, and part of that assault was that he took advantage of me sexually or forced me into sex. I generally agreed to the sex, but not tonight. And he forced me to do it tonight, and I didn't want to. Just puts, in my judgment, a little light on a difference in whether I go up to a stranger to do that, or not necessarily a stranger, but someone who hasn't, by marriage or consent, agreed to do it otherwise. Thank you.
Other comments on spousal immunity? Barry, do you have any other comments before we talk to the other witnesses?
No, I've gone through it.
Okay, fine. Maybe you hang around, though, and Judge Lewis, I certainly appreciate if you would to give us your comments.
Thank you.
Okay. Next witness then is Mrs. Carolyn Bird. She'll sit right here.
Thank you.
Could you give your name?
Yes. My name is Carolyn Berg, and I'm a citizen of the United States all my life and a resident of Juneau for approximately 24 years. And I have to give a little statement because our government is in a little different situation today than it is usually. So I do not believe that any other instrument except the Constitution of the United States and the Alaska State Constitution is the supreme law of the land, and with the exception of the 25th Amendment to the United States Constitution, which I'm challenging because it is completely unconstitutional. So that's the little statement I give before I talk. Now, I'm inclined to believe a little more with Mrs. Rudd over here in her thinking. I really feel that a little opening should be there for the woman or the man to give his particular facts if something like this happens, because there are some things that do happen once in a while, and they're quite aggravated, and I have heard of some of my friends' lives. And I feel that this law should be open to a little, to listening at least, to facts. I doubt whether this would be very many people that would bring in these facts. I don't think they would, but I really feel that it should be left open to this. And I understand Mrs. Rudd's feeling. I think she's closer to the people right now than a lot of people, because people are frustrated with their sentencing by the judges. The people feel it's just a revolving door, that the police catch them and the judges let them go. Now, I know this is not pertinent to this particular thing, but I have a little story that I wish to tell about this, because it really told me everything as far as sentencing is concerned in the state of Alaska, and I'm for stronger sentencing. In Sitka, there was a man, two men that were in the Kitsati Club, and they had been drinking a few beers, and they got into an argument. And one of the men went back at the Kitsati Club and shot the other one 4 times. Well, now the one that he shot was a native fellow, and this to me was murder. That's what I call an aggravated assault. Well, this man was brought to Juneau and had served 9 months in Juneau, and the judge let him go on a manslaughter charge. So we looked into the facts a little more, and the policeman was green. He didn't pick up the right evidence, and the judge had to bring it down to manslaughter. And now I understand, and this man had served 9 months, and the judge let him go, And now I understand this man is going to school in Anchorage at taxpayer expense. Now, to me, this is a travesty of a sentence. The man shot another man, and the Clinkett and Hydas were so upset about it that they had a meeting on it. And I was at a criminal justice meeting where the mother appeared, and she told me that she could just never understand the judge letting this man go. So I went before the judicial council and told him this story, and the judicial council said that we should have stronger sentencing for aggravated assault. So they have recommended it, and I'm all for it. I don't want this. When I worked in the U.S. Attorney's Office for manslaughter, for instance, we had a 7-year term with 4 years off for good behavior, and that man had to serve 3 years. Now, that's reasonable to me. I don't believe that a man should be sentenced to going to school up at Anchorage at taxpayers' expense when he shot a man and the policeman was green and bringing in the evidence. I believe that we should have stronger sentencing laws, and they should go back to what the U.S. Attorney's Office had 15, 20 years ago, the stronger sentencing. That's all I have to say, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Mrs. Berg. Is there any questions for Mrs. Berg?
Thank you
very much. Yes, Karen Davis. Ms. Davis has proposed some amendments to Article 4, and they've been passed around to the committee members. Do all the committee members have can you state your name for the record and the association you represent?
My name is Karen Davis, and I'm from the Juno Committee on Assault Against Women. I wasn't prepared to offer any testimony, so that's where I'm coming from right now.
Are you, who are you representing?
Juno Committee on Assaults Against Women. Our group does endorse the revision of the criminal codes, and we offered some amendments, one of which is spousal immunity, and that just went back and forth for a while, and I feel that it's not necessary to explain that anymore. Also, we're interested in limiting the evidence of the victim's prior sexual conduct to activities with the defendant and brought in the evidentiary exclusion to cover other aspects of the victim's private life. It seems that the judicial system is perpetuating the double standard where the defendant's past, let's say, not even convictions, but possible rapes cannot be brought into trial, even though there isn't in camera.
Mr. Chairman, excuse me, on that point, there is now a statute which precludes evidence of the victim's past sexual conduct. As a matter of fact, I obtained from California and sent it down to the county officials in that town. I got that California law, which subsequently came over here. So that is substantially taken care of. There are instances where it becomes relevant, where it can be brought in, but in the normal case, it is not.
Right, but even so, I realize that there is in-camera hearing, and that can include up to a year's time for the victim, and that can be brought into court if the judge, you know,
if it's determined to be relevant,
right. But we're taking
if the victim and the perpetrator has been carrying on in the past, it might become.
And we're saying that even taking that even further to say that none should be allowed for the victim's past. On assaults.
Why don't we hold off assaults to
Okay. Well, we already discussed that the other day. The main point on assaults is that it's not even deemed a crime at this point insofar as a special offense, and that maybe it can be included in family offenses, and this would give the importance that this kind of crime does deserve. And also to have the arresting officer not have to see the crime taking place, but to be able to arrest the husband in the case of battery.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dennison. Are there any questions for the any comments? Thank you very much. Oh, wait a minute.
With the committee's indulgence, could I ask the witness a brief question? I'm a little confused on the evidentiary question that you raised, which is with respect to evidence of prior sexual acts by the victim.
Yeah.
Would that include in your proposal evidence of prior sexual acts of the victim with the defendant?
Yes.
You would propose to exclude that?
Right, and just relevant to the case, to that particular case.
Would your proposal also propose to exclude a prior charge of rape that was found that was unsubstantiated?
Insofar as the defendant is concerned, to bring that up. Okay, if that was to be allowed, and then there could be more of a balance with the victim's past being allowed also.
Okay, my question was, a prior allegation of rape against either this defendant or another defendant by the same victim that resulted in acquittal or was found to be unsubstantiated.
Okay, and the question is, would that be?
Would you propose to exclude that from being gone into?
I'm not sure of this. Of that.
Comments? Thank you very much. Bob Bundy?
My name is Bob Bundy. I'm the district attorney, second district in Nome. And I've lived in Nome substantially for, say, 6 years now. Been district attorney for about a year and a half. Brief residences in Kotzebue and Anchorage. I have to express a good deal of admiration for the sexual assault laws that's been proposed here with the degrees. I must say that, as I'm sure you've heard from Mr. Stearns at length, the prior law created quite a bit of confusion, left quite a few gaps. It was difficult. Prosecution was often difficult, especially in things like assault with intent to rape, where intent was very difficult to prove, especially when you have intoxicated persons. There's always a good deal of the jury's reluctant to convict intoxicated persons, despite specific instructions. But essentially, the proposed revision gives some substance to the criminal law in terms of rational charging and I assume in putting it in classes of offenses and rational sentencing, and I'd have to give my wholehearted support. As to the issue of spousal immunity, I must say that, going on with Mrs. Rudd, there's no real analytical reason for that section. On the other hand, as in practice, as Dan Hickey brought out, and as Judge Lewis brought out, there's a tremendous opportunity for abuse. Now, because of the opportunity for abuse, all that does is make my job harder. It means that we have to screen more carefully and we have to get more people angry at us, which I think is maybe one of the, and the public defender, on the other hand, there was some talk of Barbara Miracle testifying, has got to... feels that they are going to have to defend more unjustified charges, and which may result in convictions of their clients that they're convinced are innocent by unreasonable juries. Now, I don't know how to resolve that. As I said, analytically, I don't see any real, and logically, there's no real reason to have interspousal immunity. I think Representative Dankworth touched on something in terms of, when you marry, you sort of give an overall consent. Well, I think that what analytically that may mean that what you've got is you've got, in an ordinary rape, you've got a person's dignity is absolutely infringed upon. And that's why it's a Class A felony, just put in here. A very serious crime, and under the current statute, any term of years can be punishable by any term of year. Some states, it's a capital offense in certain instances. Now, as you go, and the way the criminal code revision worked, we went down with the infringements on persons' dignity, I think, for want of a better word, down from first all the way down to fourth degree sexual assault. And placed in with the first degree of sexual assault, with the idea of only a lack of consent being the issue. issue, not fighting or any other type of thing, resistance. You've got the spousal immunity to kind of say, well, gee whiz, between a husband and a wife, it's not as serious as between strangers. Although, even with the spousal immunity, people that have been cohabitating for years even, that aren't married, you have the same problem. It's really not a serious offense. And in that case, rely on the discretion of the prosecutor and the sentencing discretion of the judge to mitigate the offense. But the fact of the matter remains is the person remains convicted of a Class A felony, even if it were a cohabitation thing. So the argument for spousal immunity is nearly as strong in the cohabitation field as it is in the marriage field. Now, there's the only proposal that I have that could balance the two, and I'm not sure that it's a wise one, but I've only seen this draft today, is that in some states, it's my understanding that there's some corroborative evidence that's required to be brought forth in a rape case. Other than the victim gets up and a person cannot be convicted on the uncorroborated word of the victim. And most states, I think, wisely so, have eliminated that because that results in some injustice when the victim just simply doesn't have anybody else around. But in this case, where we've got this problem of the alleged assault taking place in the context of a marital dispute and perhaps dissolution of the relationship, maybe this is the time to impose a little bit more so that if an uncorroborated case comes in where there appears to be some chance of substantial injustice being done, that the corroboration requirement may temper that a little bit. That's some thoughts off the top of my head, and I invite any questions or any references to my experience in the hearing.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Comments?
Well, I'm very interested in your comment, Mr. Bundy. Maybe you found the way out. On the other hand, I should think that in a marriage situation, a corroboration would be even more unlikely than in any other situation because it would be in private. It would be in their own home and likely nobody else would be around.
The corroboration could come, it could perhaps loosen the standards of what really is corroboration. You could get in specifically allowing past instances of assault or other abuse as evidence into the proceeding, whereas in another case that may not be admissible.
I don't think it would have to be restricted, for example, to direct evidence. It could be circumstantial evidence,
right.
And physical evidence that would corroborate testimony. It wouldn't have to be another witness. In other words, it could be certain kinds of injuries. It could be any of a number of things, I suppose. There is a provision, for example, in the existing statute that prevents a conviction on the uncorroborated testimony of an accomplice. It requires some corroboration in order to convict a defendant where you've got an accomplice testifying against him, an admitted accomplice.
Comments? Questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Bundy. I appreciate your time. Ann Carbonetti?
Well, I guess you wanted to maybe tell her about the conference in Seattle.
If you would, yes. Could you come up?
Sure.
And
LEAA. Ann Carbonetti from the Department of Law. LEAA had a conference in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, and they invited people from Alaska and various other western states, Oregon and Washington. And the subject of the conference was rape and its victims. It was mainly concerned with what happens to a victim of rape after the rape occurs. So in that sense, it's not that relevant to what this committee is considering at this time. The two main problems that they started out with were, one, that most rapes are not reported, at least from the statistics that they can get. I don't know how accurate they are, but I think it's, Gina might be, like, Karen was there, maybe one rape in five is even reported to the police. And those that are recorded, oftentimes the prosecuting witness drops out for one reason or another. And the conference was addressing the reasons for that and what can be done to keep the victims in the criminal justice system and to attract them to it in the first place, to report crimes to the police. And some of the solutions were, of course, what this committee is addressing is a rationalization of the statutes. Apparently, a lot of victims think, well, why should I report this? The laws are crazy. I don't want to put my reputation and my dignity on the line if I go to court and have to be cross-examined about my prior sexual life. And the main suggestions that the workshops came up with were community organization and cooperation among prosecuting attorneys, counseling, this would concern the legislature, I think, trying to establish crisis counseling for victims and their families, whether the victim is a man or a woman. The victim has to go back to society and live, and so does the spouse, and that's often difficult. And there aren't the resources in this state for that kind of counseling, although Anchorage and Juneau and some other communities are starting voluntary crisis lines. They have counselors attend with the victim to go to court and explain to them. So many of the victims are so confused by the criminal justice system. They don't know where to go. They get lost. They're frustrated. They're not treated with sensitivity. And that was the reason the conference was held. If you have any questions, I guess it doesn't really concern this legislation very directly.
I appreciate your taking the time to bring us up to date. Are there questions from the committee members?
Yeah, I was just concerned. In terms of the definition of without consent, we say with or without resisting. Do you think that'll encourage?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. This whole system of bringing the sexual assault statutes into some kind of rationality will certainly, I think, help.
Is there anybody else who'd like to make any final comments?
No, I'm shot my mind.
Judge Lewis?
Yes, I would, if I may.
Sure.
On the point of first of resistance, which the proposed redraft eliminates, I have consistently instructed juries that resistance is not necessary if the woman is put in fear. In other words, if the consent was accompanied by fear on her part, no act of resistance is required. We've never gone the Indiana route of saying that she has to resist all the way and throughout the course of the crime. So I'm not sure that really is a major concern in prosecution under the present statute as it exists. That if the woman is put in fear, the absence of consent, of course, then this is implicit in the whole commission of the crime. The real problem, as I see it, is whether or not the new code or the existing code is adopted is the difficulty of prosecution, the reluctance of the victim to come forward. How is the criminal justice system going to treat her? I think it's essential that her past, even more relevant than this now considered to be. If the woman has had prior, and usually the woman we're talking about in these situations, the sexual abuse. If the woman is going to be exposed in any way, I think she's going to be reluctant to come forward in any event, whether or not there's a statute which, at least in some part, protects her as it does now. And I'm not sure that the new statute is going to effectuate. The other thing is the great reluctance of juries to convict for whether you call it rape or sexual assault. They just don't like to hang a crime as serious as this is upon when they have to weigh the testimony of a victim versus the testimony of the assailant, which usually in rape cases the defendant comes forward as well, unless has a prior record. And I just, from a number of cases that I've tried, very few of them result in guilty verdicts. Despite the fact that I could perceive that beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was guilty, it's just extremely hard to reach to bank convictions. And I don't don't know whether the new statute's going to change that.
Mr. Stern, on that matter, I don't see it in the new statute where this particular question that addressed is going to ease the emotional burden on the woman to make her more willing than one in five to come forward. I don't see that in this statute. Was that addressed by the commission? And if so, what were the results?
I assume that you are asking me whether we have considered rules of evidence in terms of making the victim come forward. And we did not, as this was a substantive revision, and we did not consider, for example, whether past conduct can be admitted. That is a task. One of the tasks for our commission is to revise the Code of Criminal Procedure. We have the time. That will be one of the issues considered. But we did not consider that issue of the evidence, as it was beyond the scope of this project.
But aside from, excuse me, go ahead, Mr.
Yeah,
Stern.
But I do recognize that is an important concern. The thing that we wanted to do in this code is at least to make the statute, at least that a conviction would not be, to prevent a conviction from not being obtained because the statute might be interpreted as requiring resistance. I pointed out, and as Judge Lewis observed, it's probably not likely at all that the Supreme Court would interpret the statute on appeal as requiring forcible resistance to the end. But the argument is still there. I think someone could come into court and argue that for the instruction. And we wanted to eliminate any possibility of that. So it's a beginning, I think, you know, in that regard. There is a chance under that statute. It says forcibly, I believe, and with against the will,
against the will
forcibly. So it's two elements there. It's without consent, plus it's forcible. And I think that I think the argument could be made, if I had a case, I think I would try to argue very strongly that forcibly and against the will, there are two things there. It has to be force, and it has to continue, and it has to be against her will. I believe, though, that the instructions that are currently given, though, are more restrictive than that in terms of saying that it could be a threat and resistance doesn't have to continue. But the argument can be made under the existing law that is not the case.
Just two very brief things, Mr. Chairman. One is, on that particular point, it hasn't been my experience that all judges are as judicious about their instructions as Judge Lewis is. And as Mr. Stern has emphasized, the argument is available, and I am familiar with the occasional case where instructions do get in on resistance, and they certainly raise arguments. And one of the points in the code is to the extent possible, eliminate disparity in instructions. That instructions are a critical element of the criminal law. That they, if you will, to a large extent, determine the result, their outcome determinative, and they vary from one judge to another. The code attempts to refine the law to the point where instructions will, of necessity, be uniform. And I think in this area hopefully the subcommittee has done that. The other point I wanted to offer, just by way of information for the committee's benefit, is that on the question of evidence and rules of evidence, there is a committee that's just been formed, I believe, under the auspices of the Supreme Court. Judge Lewis may be familiar with it. I believe that Judge Stewart here in Juneau, and Judge Brenner in Anchorage are co-chairmen of that, and it involves a cross-spectrum of people, including prosecutors and defense attorneys, to deal with rules of evidence, to propose a set of uniform rules of evidence for consideration by the Supreme Court, which we don't have, either by statute or by court rule in this state. And any contribution, I think, either the House or Senate Judiciary Committees or both jointly would care to make to that committee, I'm sure would be welcome on a point such as this.
Thank you. Maybe I didn't make my question clear, a layman speaking to three legal people. But the question is, aside from your dialogues on uniform rules of evidence, judicial instructions, convictions, is there any way we can legislate to make it easy for a rape victim and comfortable for a rape victim to come in and make the complaint if we're only getting one out of five? Can we legislate that?
Well, I think you could eliminate some of the impediments, and one of the impediments I think that Ann was mentioning is perhaps under the existing statute, the rape victim would have to would not come in unless she was bruised, unless she can show some kind of physical injury, and we specifically say it's not necessary. You don't have to resist. You don't have to have physical injury. So that's one aspect of it. And being able, frankly, I think an important aspect is that after the rape occurs, the victim may decide to go down and see what the law is on rape. If the victim does that today, she won't know what the law is today because that term is not defined in the statute, forcibly and against the will. She comes down today, you know, when a revised code is passed, she could sit down, open that up, and say, yes, I was coerced by the use of force, and it says I didn't have to resist. And hopefully it's going to prompt her to go to the DA's office. That's the beginning. I think the other points that were all taken, though, in terms of the rules of evidence.
So some other things the legislation could conceivably do is consider some specific programs by legislation. They would obviously involve appropriations, but to create a victim assistance program, particularly in the in our major urban centers, Anchorage and Fairbanks in particular, where there is a fairly large incidence of rape offenses, to give police agencies in the state the resources to devote extra attention to that kind of offense, to develop experts at their investigation, to give my office the resources to develop a specialist, if you will, in the area of sex prosecutions and how to develop the right kind of a relationship with the victim. Any of a number of things like that, which are way beyond, of course, the purview of this code. But there are things that can be done.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Caponetti, would you like to comment?
The report on the status of women came up with some good suggestions, too.
Okay. Representative Rudd asked me to pass this along to you. She said one of the things you can do is train police officers in sensitive areas. But I don't know if it was mentioned when I was
here. Are sensitive areas erogenous zones?
No, I don't think she referred to that.
They don't need me checking that, for the record.
Any final comments? Senator Coleman, do you have any closing comments?
Let us adjourn.
Thank you.